The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today is a stalwart of the Labour Party. From a politically active family, her career saw her work at various charities and think tanks before becoming executive director of the social change organisation, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Her first book, The New Working Class, How to Win Hearts, Minds and Votes, brought her to the attention of the Labour leadership. And not long after Keir Starmer's successful leadership bid, she joined him as executive director of policy, a position she held for over 2 years. She now chairs the Building Back Britain Commission and is leading a project on the renewal of the centre-left at the think tank, the Progressive Policy Institute. My guest today is Claire Ainslie. Claire, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. We've been keen to have you on for a while. And we always begin by saying, was yours a happy childhood?
Well, thank you very much for having me on. Yes, it was a happy childhood, certainly until my parents divorced in my teen years, which was a bit of a rougher ride. But we grew up in southwest London with my mum and dad until I was 13 and brother. And it was a very political household, so very politically active, current affairs. The Radio 4 was on all of the time. It was football and politics, and that's what we talked about. My mum was really active in the Labour Party. She was a proud old Labour person, really active in the 1997 general election, where she helped win the seat of Wimbledon, which was one of those extraordinary results on the night. So politics was very much something we talked about in the household. And I think that had a huge influence on me. Nobody in the family had gone to university before me and my brother then went. And we definitely saw education as being part of the kind of the route to like bettering yourself. The family background was really from the northeast of England. So my granddad on my mum's side was a miner who came to London to become a policeman. And I was always really interested in the social history of our family and what that then meant for us today.
And am I right to say your granddad policed the Battle of Cable Street?
Yeah, so I found out a lot of social history about my family as I grew up. And I think one of the things that I really loved was my mum telling me stories about our family. And she came from a very large family, and her mum, my grandmother, would tell her some of these stories. And one of them was that my grandfather, who'd been a miner as a young man in County Durham, came south to become a policeman, and he met my nan, who was also from Sunderland, and he policed the Battle of Cable Street. And I think one of the things that I thought was that's always found really, really fascinating is how when you come from like the archetypal working class background, how you find yourself in that position. And it was one of the things that then drove me to want to kind of research and root myself in working class politics, because I think that that is something that is got a specific historical context, but we see the roots of that in the rise today of why the centre-left has to have a better alternative to the political right.
And you mentioned, obviously, family long tradition of being from the left. Does that mean, was it just a general sense in the family that you were Labour and you didn't really think about other parties probably when you were younger?
Yeah, there was no truck with, we were anti-Tory and grew up in the Thatcher years. So like lots of kids who grew up in that kind of 80s, early 90s, our whole school celebrated when Thatcher was booted out.
What did you do?
Well, there was just a sense of jubilation. Like there was just a sense of jubilation, apart from my mum, who said I wanted her booted out at the ballot box. Like she was the only one that was upset because she wanted to see her gone. And actually, one of my earliest memories is around that time of 1992. And I remember her waking me up and sitting in my bed in the morning of the 1992 election, and she was crying. And she was said, you know, we've lost. And so many people in the run-up to that election thought that Labour was going to win that election. And it stayed with me for a very long time, right the way up through to this election campaign, where there were many veterans of the 1992 campaign, and people who remember it, who were haunted by that prospect of Labour thinking that they were going to win and not doing it in the end.
Yeah, I've always found that covering Labour, particularly in recent years, as the polls have looked so good for Labour, obviously perhaps less so right now, but in advance of the election. And she'd say, oh, and they say, no, we cannot have another Kinnock. And they said, you know, we are just traumatised, even up until the minute before, at the sense of always being on the losing side more times than not. Now, how did you find school? Were you particularly studious? Did you know what you wanted to do at that point?
I was pretty studious up until the teen years, where I definitely was much less studious. I was pretty bored. I wasn't in a great, it is now an outstanding secondary school, but it definitely wasn't an outstanding secondary school when I went. It was not a place that you felt particularly safe at. And it actually was notorious because it was in the Evening Standard, we had a fight with a Catholic girls' school in our local town in southwest London. And the Evening Standard drew a caricature of a rather large St Trinian schoolgirl saying St Trinian's rides again. And they covered quite humorously this big, huge fight between the two girls' schools. But that wasn't the best environment to try and sort of get an education out of. So I'm actually a big defender of Ofsted, because I think that actually that kind of transparency to parents has been really, really important in driving up standards. Proud to say that my lovely goddaughter goes there now, and it's an outstanding school, and her sister. So things have changed a lot, but it definitely wasn't an environment where, you know, you felt like you were able to achieve your best. But it was, you know, state school that ended at 16. I then left with enough GCSEs to get onto A-levels, and then went to a great sixth form in outer London, and things sort of changed from there.
And from there you go to York. But at this point you're already, I think, a member of the Labour Party, right? From the age of 15.
Yeah. So the only thing that changed when I joined the Labour Party was that rather than me being given a fiver to go and deliver my mum's Labour Party round of leaflets, then she said, oh, well, now you're a member, you don't get the money, you should do this out of the conviction. But it was an exciting time to join the Labour Party. Me and my best friend joined the Labour Party together, and I remember we were invited to an event at the House of Parliament, and Gordon Brown addressed us, and it was when Labour were in opposition, and they really made young people feel like we were part of something changing. And it was an exciting time to be a young Labour member.
You get to university, you go to York to study politics. Initial impressions, I think at this point you actually become briefly involved with the hard left, to your mother's scepticism.
She was so sceptical. So I joined university, and Labour then had been elected whilst I was at university, and lots of us being told that, you know, how brilliant it was going to be under Labour, and, you know, the sun would shine every single day once we got rid of the Tories. Of course, it wasn't like that. And one of the first things Labour did was introduce tuition fees. So as a sort of new student, I thought this was pretty awful, and then joined the Socialist Workers Student Society really in sort of protest all of this. And I remember telling my mum, and she was just so disdainful about this choice. She just said, oh, well, I once went to the International Socialists, which was their predecessor, I believe. She said, oh, well, I once went to one of their meetings, and they were so excited to see a working class woman. It was probably the first one they'd ever met in their lives. But they were totally impractical, not realistic about the way the world is. So, you know, once I wasn't a student and entered the world of work, it kind of didn't really make sense anymore. But yeah, she was totally looked down her nose at this joining the hard left.
And what was your perception of it? Did you find it was also full of a bunch of posh kids who probably hadn't really had much experience of what it's really like to be working class?
It was a real mix, I think. And I think there's lots of people who are idealistic when they're young, and there's lots of people who have, you know, I think, good socialist principles all the way through. But I think what I just found, particularly once I then came on to work at a trade union, which from the outside people think that trade unions are really left-wing places, but actually on the inside, they're actually about getting deals for their members and about their industrial agenda. And left-wing politics didn't really have very much, I think, to offer those workers. So once I was a staff member at a trade union, any kind of allegiance I had to far-left politics certainly went once I was confronted with the reality of what people actually want from their lives, which is to generally go out to work so that they can enjoy their lives and provide for people.
And I suppose just on that trade union point, I was having an interesting discussion recently with one of the new Labour MPs. And for our listeners, I mean, as you say, I think lots of people will say, oh, trade union, that must be part of the hard left. But actually, for example, how would you define the difference in the sense that when there was the recent arms embargo on parts of, you know, some arms going to Israel, you'll speak to some MPs who thought this was the worst, you know, a good thing the government had done, but they should go even further. And then actually the trade unionists were saying, well, hang on a minute, what does that mean for jobs for my constituents?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way to understand trade unions is to understand that their primary purpose is to represent their members. And to do that, they have to represent workers as they are, not the aspirations that, you know, the far left might have for them. And the moment that kind of really kind of I remember really, really clearly is sitting in a very big car plant. The bosses had gone out. The plant was threatened with closure. And the then general secretary turned round to the workforce and said, you have got to fight this closure. You have got to fight this closure. If you don't fight this one, the next one will go, the next one will go, the next one will go. And obviously lots of car plants by this point, we're talking about that the 2000s are gone by then. And you could just see, I got in the car, that workers were not going to vote for a strike action over the closure. And I got in the car with him afterwards, and you could just see in his eyes that he wanted them to vote for strike action. He gave them every support from the union. But what people wanted to do is they knew this was coming. They wanted to negotiate the very best deal that they could. So I think when you actually root your politics and what people want for themselves, it doesn't take you to a place of revolution. It is about bread and butter issues. And that's primarily what trade unions are about.
Now, you finish at York, and I think in your 20s, your mother passes away, and you've spoken about how this is actually quite a politicising experience for you in some ways.
Well, I mean, it was devastating to lose my mum really, really suddenly in my 20s, and she'd always been a really big influence on my life, and her politics were a really strong part of how I grew up. And I think I still carry much of that to this day. So as I said, she had no truck with kind of revolutionary socialist politics, but she would have called herself a socialist. She would have said that, you know, if you had 10 quid, it's about what you do with that 10 quid, but people don't start from the same point. They all start from a basis of inequality, and that's what we need to rectify. So I think that I've never really kind of had that leave me, and I suspect I never will. And I think that she was also very strongly kind of moral and principled. And I think that probably came from the kind of Methodist upbringing of my grandfather. So whilst losing her was totally devastating, I'm sure it will have galvanised me. And I'm sure it's what's fueled much more of my interest in our own family's background and social history.
You know, you've worked at various charities, think tanks, and the Joseph Rowntree Foundation was obviously a very senior role you had. But I suppose just in your own words, I mean, your path to that point, was it purposeful in the sense that you wanted to get more and more involved in politics and social causes?
I mean, none of it's been very purposeful.
Yeah,
I mean,
there's often not really a master plan, is there?
I know. And like, I sort of, and I've now got children of kind of secondary school age, and obviously around them a lot, and you're sort of thinking about what they might do. And really, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I've just followed my nose as what's the most interesting thing to go to next. So I really just followed my interests, and that's the same that happened with the job that I had working for Keir Starmer was about following my own interests, and the same with Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Always really interested in the story of Rowntree. I think this idea of a very kind of philanthropic, pioneering, social reforming businessman, I think always really fascinated me. And of course his base was in York, which is where I went to university. So I love the idea that you could, he had this idea of getting to the root causes of what he called social evils. And we describe that as poverty. And that's what I thought was really, really important, was that it's shouldn't to me just be about charitable causes, about ameliorating the effects of poverty. Rowntree said there'd always be somebody to fund the soup kitchen in York. What he wanted to do was find out the cause of poverty, and his son Sebum went on to map poverty in York and London, and these were these really kind of seismic studies. So for me, I think that root causes analysis has always been really, really important. And then I think what working for a trade union, the Labour Party, is about for me is about people taking those matters into their own hands, that it's not just about researching them, it's about people doing that for themselves. And whilst I was at Joseph Rowntree Foundation, we did a lot more work where we supported people who've got direct experience of poverty to form into organisations, poverty truth commissions, those sorts of things, to be able to give voice to their own experience and change their circumstances for the better.
And your book, The New Working Class, I mentioned in the introduction, at what point did you think, you know, all the work I've been doing, I want to put it in one place and I have a thesis? Or did just someone approach you? How does it come about?
Well, it all came about because of the Clacton by-election, that there was this fascination with, I mean, our fascination with the polls is, I think, quite a recent phenomenon. We've not been as interested in the polls as we are now. And there was this real fascination with Clacton. It was the first moment, I think, that the kind of more Westminster-focused lobby really started to pay attention to what was going on elsewhere in the country, that there was this discontent. So pre the referendum, what was going on? So at the time with Joseph Rowntree, I spoke to Julie Runwin, our pioneering chief exec at the time, and said, look, part of the reason why people don't listen to people in poverty is that they're not organised in the same way as trade unions are. Couldn't we help do some of that ourselves? And as well as the organisation, do some of the kind of public opinion polling. So what happened was we then worked with NatSen, the brilliant National Centre for Social Research, to really understand from that sort of true to our foundations, our history, the research on how people actually felt about different issues. So we would publish that research as well as encouraging organisations of people in on low incomes. And it was just so clear that this desire for change, people's discontent with their circumstances, was so prevalent really around people to low to middle incomes. So when the Brexit referendum came along, although I voted Remain and I wish we had remained in the European Union, in a sense, like we'd seen all of this in the data beforehand, that people were not content with their circumstances and Brexit was an opportunity to vote for change. And that's what they did.
So were you surprised when that result came through?
I was surprised on the morning, yeah. I mean, I not shocked, because I'd worried. And I think having moved from London up to York a few years previously, although York was solidly Remain, I spent a lot of time in North Yorkshire, and like the UKIP banners that were out, like you wouldn't see those in London, but you absolutely saw them in other parts of the country. So I was surprised, even though I thought it could go for Leave, but kind of reconciled myself quickly to thinking we've got to get on with it and make the most of this. And I think partly the only thing I wish had come out of it and hasn't come out of it is that I wish it had been this wake-up call about people on low incomes, because it really was such a big voice domestically for people to say this wasn't really about the European Union, this was about change. And Boris Johnson, for a time, gave voice to that change with Levelling Up. And I'm hopeful that Labour will take some of that agenda forward.
And you mentioned Labour, so you've really helped with my segue. because that book, I believe, is what led Morgan McSweeney to get in touch with you. And can you talk us through that? And then obviously the path to advising Labour as you did.
Sure. So 2016 was where I started to think about and create the book, and wrote it in 2017 and published in 2018. And of course, 2016 was really important because it was what was happening in this country in terms of the referendum and this sort of bewilderment of people about why people had voted for Brexit when it was so obviously not in their interests, largely amongst Remainers having that view. And of course, in the States, where we saw Donald Trump being elected, and again, that same reaction of people feeling very sort of aghast that this had been people's response. And I felt it was because the centre-left weren't coming up with an alternative that was really gripping people about change.
And did you think the response was a bit dismissive of some of it?
I thought the response was dismissive. I thought people were looked down on for how they voted. I thought there was no empathy with why somebody might have voted to leave the European Union. And I found that repulsive, that attitude. I thought it was so wrong. And I thought our job on the centre-left should have been to, you know, accept that that's how people had voted and come up with our best version of. But I also thought we really had to get under the causes, because leaving the European Union sure wasn't going to address the causes of why people felt so aggrieved, I thought, in the first place. So writing the book was a way of articulating some of that and doing it from a really evidenced viewpoint. So rather than just, as we talked about earlier, the sort of left saying, this is what, you know, working class people think, well, let's get under the skin of it and actually listen to people and represent that in some kind of new agenda. So it described a different working class, to say this wasn't just about the traditional working class that used to exist, which is an important part of the population, it's quite small. It's actually about putting it together with the more modern working class, so people who work in the service industry, who are not in some far-off, distant northern town or city. They are people who are living and working amongst all of us all of the time. And at the time, I obviously wanted to write it as a book for Labour. I was working for a politically independent organisation, Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and it was important that it was independent. And it was actually the Tories who were much more interested in it at the time. So I did not market it to the Tories, but they were much more interested.
How does it feel just when you obviously, you know, we talked about your upbringing, where you sit politically since, you know, member since the age of 15. You write this book, you know, not your life's work is maybe being slightly, but, you know, a huge amount of work has gone into it. And then all of a sudden all the Tories are more interested.
Well, it is quite interesting, I think, that Labour, I really pushed it to Labour, and they just were not in a headspace to be able to deal with it at that time. I actually personally wrote to John McDonnell. You know, his politics are not the same as mine, but I do really respect him, and I did get a meeting with him, but they didn't particularly follow it up. Tories, on the other hand, they do not mind where they get their ideas from. It was clear that I was, you know, left-leaning. So they were much more interested, because they will go wherever they need. They're like magpies for new political ideas, which I think is really interesting. But Labour's...
Who got in touch from the Tories?
So Jack Dromey, the late Jack Dromey, who was Deputy General Secretary at the Transport and General Workers Union, and he had gone through the whole book. It was very much his politics. I think it was saying some things in there which were not comfortable for Labour at the time. So some of the policies that were about a points-based migration system, which was not where Labour were, about accepting the EU result, some of the points on kind of welfare, things that were not popular. So it didn't quite get the traction at the time. But Jack put me in touch with Steve Reed, who is now Environment Secretary. Steve was working with Labour together, and of course, Morgan McSweeney, who were forming much of the backbone of what would then become Labour's agenda, both in terms of understanding the membership and how, when Corbyn's time came to an end, the membership could be led to then vote for a candidate who would be more of the country, not just the party. And of course, what would be that agenda coming forward? So I had some really fruitful meetings, not just with Steve, but with Morgan McSweeney, who was director of Labour Together at that time, and was really just struck by the analysis that he had and that we shared of Labour having left working class people behind, but it also not being a nostalgic look back to what the working class was, but a much more contemporary analysis that is rooted more in people's community in their place. And those conversations then led to becoming a little bit involved with Keir's campaign behind the scenes to become leader, and then becoming his head of policy when he was successful.
Just when talking about the new working class, I mean, some people call, I think, some of the politics that we're talking about there, blue Labour. Do you think that's a fair description, or does it miss...
Yeah, I think blue Labour has been an influential part. I think it's been a school of thought that has been important and influential. But I don't really describe what Labour's doing now as sort of classic blue Labour. I think it's much more contemporary, actually. I also think it has to embrace an innovative pro-enterprise economy. I think what blue Labour did was be the first school of thought to be able to offer something that was about community and place and belonging for the centre-left after the financial crisis in 2007 and 2008. And I think we haven't really had its contemporary successor yet. So I think it's influenced by blue Labour, but not blue Labour.
And you mentioned, obviously, the role you took on. How did you find working in Westminster? We're talking about, obviously, being in York. Obviously, you're from London originally. It's quite a unique ecosystem.
It's a unique ecosystem, as you know. It was a strange time, actually, because we were so far away. We were like 26 points behind, and quite a united team, actually. But that way that you're united when you believe that it's possible, but not everybody else does at the time. So there was quite a big persuasion job, I think, even within the party. To give it its confidence back, morale was really, really low. And there were Labour HQ was not an active headquarters really until well after the pandemic. Of course, it was going through the changeover from Corbyn. Then Westminster itself was not the place that you know it as now. It was a place that was generally deserted much of the time, even when there weren't the full-on lockdowns. You can have exemptions to work, legal exemptions to work, but most of us were working remotely because you had to do that for the circumstances. So it was quite strange forming a team in a time where Labour's morale was shot. We'd lost four elections. We'd got a good analysis of what Labour had together had done, but we didn't quite have our prospectus for what we want to do in the future. And most of what people are interested in is what you're saying about the pandemic, which essentially is kind of public health and economic judgments. We didn't have the insight then that we obviously have now as to the role of lockdowns. And as the new Conservative leader will find, if you're behind in the polls, and even when, you know, things change, this far out from an election, people aren't terribly interested in what you've got to say. So I would say we use that period well to get a lot of stuff done that we needed to be able to change the party, to make sure that it faced the country again, rather than having an inward conversation with itself.
And just picking up on something you said, and if I'm picking up wrong, we can leave it. But I just wondered, you mentioned that you didn't have the sense of the cost of lockdowns at that point. Do you think with hindsight, the kind of consensus position in Labour Party, which was often being more pro continuing lockdowns or warning, you know, caution in that sense, has aged less well?
I mean more that the space that you had as an opposition to talk about issues was much reduced because we were in a national crisis, and like the public were not going to thank Labour for saying anyway about our policy about this long-term thing, which you clearly aren't going to be
all voting on. Let's have a battle of ideas.
Yeah. Like, that was not where the public were at. They were like, get on with it. We were in a national crisis. We're all making huge sacrifices here. Whether we would have made different decisions on lockdown, like certainly I think with the evidence you had available, I think the decisions that were made in government and by the opposition were really credible, the only decisions that could be made at the time. I think there is obviously a much bigger question if we were to have a pandemic in future, what we need to learn coming out of that last pandemic, because I think there's no guarantee that people would comply in the way that they complied. I think that schools in particular, I think the damage that we've done to our young people is disgraceful. And I think that there needs to be a payback for those young people. And we haven't talked about that enough. I also know that Keir Starmer worked very, very hard to get those schools to reopen and do as much pressure as we could on that. So I think that's an area that could have been different. But I don't think on the whole, we would have approached it very differently given what we knew then. It's more that it was such a weird time to be in opposition because you were both providing an opposition, but actually you were doing the responsible thing, which is backing the government where you needed to.
And also if you oppose things too hard, everyone said, that is not in the national interest. So it's a very strange time to kind of be in that position.
Yeah, of course. And you're getting briefings from scientists and so on and so forth. Yeah. And you're actually, what I think it did do is to find some of Keir's politics in the decisions that he made. So I think his decision to put the national interest first, not oppose for the sake of it, was very much how he wanted to lead the party. That wasn't universally popular in the Labour Party. They might have liked to have seen more opposition. That was not what he felt the responsible thing to do was. Lots of opposition around schools reopening. Keir was the person that was really pushing for schools to reopen as soon as they possibly could. So I think what it did was show us that he was prepared to do the right thing, not the easy thing.
And am I right to say, in your policy role, you're the first woman to take on that title for the Labour Party?
I think so. And Anushka Astana, in her excellent Taken as Red book, says that she can't think of one and I haven't. But certainly my immediate predecessors were all men.
And how did you find that? Because often you read things, you know, such as like, to be fair, I think you get this across all political parties. But, you know, with Labour saying, oh, you know, it's the boys, Morgan and the boys. Did you find it was a place where you were quite happy working? Was there anything that was trickier because you're a woman? Or?
So it definitely was a place that I was happy working in as a woman and felt comfortable and didn't feel that my gender was the most relevant thing about me doing that job. I think it was more relevant, to be honest, that I'd come from outside of Westminster and was pushing an agenda which was about rooting our policy in the priorities and values of working class people, or, you know, today's working class, if you like. That was a bigger challenge, and that was the more relevant thing. The leadership team that Keir had was like women was 50-50, male, female. He has lots of very strong women around. And I also think I could see that he took pride in when the female politicians around him were doing well. I could see he took pride in that and took strength from that. So I think he set a culture and an environment that was actually where women could thrive in. That said, policy is not something that you get as many women in as men. So of course there are challenges for that. I think the women on the team tended to attract a bit more attention and sometimes a bit more stick, and that continues. So it's not without its challenges, but I would say that the description that others have had of it being a very male environment wasn't what I experienced. But that said, I still think that society has problems with women doing those sorts of jobs, and the Labour Party is no different. So you have to be prepared, I'm afraid, when you're doing them and it's not many women that have gone before you, to do things in a different way and just be confident that's the right thing to do.
And you left after 2 years, I think for family reasons. Your kids were growing up. You were based in York, and commuting probably isn't the simplest thing. We're talking before we start recording it. It's just one of those very all-consuming type jobs if you work in Westminster. Do you feel, as you know, looking at that general election, though, where Keir Starmer obviously went on to win big, that, you know, some of the policy work you did planted the seeds for some of the direction, for the direction? Because that idea of listening to working people was something which really underpinned the Labour message.
Yeah, I did. And I felt that I left at the end of 2022. And of course, some people sort of said at that time, well, look, Labour on the up now. And when we started, it was a bit of a, you know, a belief rather than, you know, fact that
less
we were gonna,
attractive
a
prospect.
Less attractive prospect. But I really believed in what we were trying to do. And I believed in what Keir was doing, what Morgan was doing, to basically take the Labour Party back to working people. So I definitely feel that, like, lots of the policy work that we've got done, that foundation was laid in lots of the big pieces of work that we did, whether it was around our kind of our fiscal responsibility, industrial strategy, employment rights. I also think that we got away from talking about issues that I would describe as a bit niche to the Labour Party. So a lot of it was about what we didn't talk about as much as what we did talk about. But credit is to the team that have then taken it forward, and also particularly to the Shadow Cabinet that was then appointed at that time, that have really then accelerated and I think given a lot more depth to that platform that we put out. So I definitely didn't think it was kind of job done, but I was definitely at the point where my family needs were going to overtake what I could do in those jobs, and I felt proud of what we'd achieved so far, and I've been excited to see what they've done with it since.
And obviously it's been a bit of a bumpy start to Labour's time in government. We've also just had the budget, which I think within the parliamentary Labour Party is landing all right at the moment, but outside of Parliament, that's facing more criticism, whether it's business or markets. Do you think that the new Labour government is sticking to these priorities when it comes to the working class listening to those interests? And is there anything more you'd like to see?
The biggest thing that this government can do for working people up and down the country is have a stable economy that allows them to thrive, to get paid decently at work, but really importantly, to make sure that their employers are able to thrive. Because if they don't, if we don't have prosperity, then we know that the slow growth that we get or negative as a result of that impacts on those families. So the stable economy is the most important thing. So I know that there is a watch on the markets at the moment, but it does feel like there has been a good reaction overall. I think Labour have made some really big judgment calls around investment. I'm delighted to see that, because I think that we've underinvested in the economy. And what's going to be then really important is that people start to feel the benefits of that. And the work that I now do for the Progressive Policy Institute is looking at the global centre-left, and particularly learning from what the US administration have got right and wrong. And I think they were absolutely right to invest, and I think it's the right economic policy for the centre-left. But you cannot guarantee that that has one vote with it. You can invest, but it is not necessarily what people are going to feel in their pockets. So I think that for the Labour government, having an absolute focus on living standards, so basically people feeling that their wages are going further within a fairly short space of time, is going to be really important. And Labour having the proof points to be able to say, yes, this is how I'm feeling better off compared to how I was feeling under the Conservatives. And they've got to not take their eye off that ball.
Yeah, that's what you need to be able to point to. And you mentioned the Progressive Policy Institute. Can you just talk listeners through that? Because obviously, as a Washington focus, you're still in York going across. So what work are you doing there?
So PPI, Progressive Policy Institute, is a brilliant think tank that has long been friends to the centre-left globally and to the Labour Party in particular. It was really instrumental in the third way discussions during the 1990s, when there was obviously a big kind of resurgence of left of centre thinking. And it was set up by our fantastic founder, Will Marshall, who is still our president today. Much of their policy work is US facing, but they've always had this kind of outward looking role. And the project that I'm doing on the global centre-left is really looking at, where is the centre-left winning and why? Who are we winning? And what can we learn from it? And how do you have a centre-left agenda that's really going to beat back right-wing populism? Because the causes of right-wing populism are not going anywhere. The right-wing populists are not going anywhere. And I think in the long run, the only way we can defeat them isn't by better electoral tactics. It will be by having a better prospectus for working people. So that's the kind of essence of the project. And we've been facilitating some of the conversations and relationships across the Atlantic.
And I've only got a couple more questions. I could talk to you for much longer, but I feel like you might have stuff to do your day. On the, you know, that side of the Atlantic, we obviously recently had Donald Trump, and we're recording before the election result, and this will go out after, not being particularly happy at the idea of some Labour figures going on, perhaps on their own expenses, to go and campaign. And also, I think the PPI came up in some of those conversations around it. What was that like from where you were sitting? Just a normal day in the office? Or?
I think it is for the US. I think they are used to, and I think if Trump wins and we don't know what's going to happen, we are going to have to get used to a new normal of what is considered normal. And what was really interesting was following it in the States, where it didn't really register as a huge story, but the media over here followed it, like, just faithfully. You know, they just faithfully followed the story. And I thought, if we're going to have to deal with Trump as a actor in our, not just in our politics, but in our media more often, we're going to have to get used to asking more questions about, well, why? Why is the campaign doing this? What is it they're trying to say with this? What might they be trying to detract attention from? Like, look more critically at our politicians.
Are they trying to get their voters out? That type
of
thing.
Yeah, just a deeper level of analysis rather than, I have just received this piece of campaign information and I'm going to read it to you. I think there just has to be a much deeper level of scrutiny over what our politicians are doing and why they're doing, because we are going to be in a different order if that is the case.
So you're not a sinister electoral force trying to bring down the Republican Party?
Funnily enough, not.
Just sort of check.
And actually, you know, and PPI's work itself, was anything we've done has been sort of transparent. We've done, you know, events and that sort of thing. This sort of stuff has been going on, and it's a good thing, and the Republicans and the Tories do it, and so they should. Shouldn't they learn from each other? The difference now is how the Trump campaign then used this as a campaign tactic, and kind of, I feel like the media fell for it, rather than going, why are we being used as a tool in this campaign, and how do we be an objective questioner of what's actually going on here?
You mentioned there, you know, forces on the right, something that the centre-left is going to have to grapple with. Here in the UK, how do you see the Reform Party and Nigel Farage? Is that, we hear in Number 10, they take it quite seriously. Do you think that, you know, some people want to say, oh, it's an election blip. Do you think that is a force that the current Labour government's really going to have to reckon with?
I do. I think it is important. And I think if you look at July's vote, I think the split from the main parties didn't show itself up in terms of the parliamentary majority that Labour got, but it did show itself in terms of the way that people voted. So I don't think it's just Reform. I think you have to look more generally about why people are voting for a spread of parties, even when they know they might not get that party represented. So I do think it's important to see it as more than a blip.
And would you include pro-Gaza parties and kind of that spread of smaller parties
in
there?
Like there's different things going on.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing that we're seeing in parts of Europe where they have different electoral systems. We just don't have an electoral system to represent that split vote. Labour's best bet is to be that broad church and to kind of straddle that coalition between new sort of working class voters and more sort of socially liberal middle class people. That is their only kind of coalition that holds. So I don't think you need to treat it as more than a blip, but I would maintain that the best way to fight it is to come up with a better agenda for working people and to deliver on it. I mean, that's what the expectation is for Labour, and that's what certainly the work I will do would be helping them to achieve.
And just to end for the final question on working class, Kemi Badenoch is now the new leader of the Tory party. So any views on her? But she made a comment during the leadership election about class, and lots of the parts of the left got very agitated by it. I think Kemi Badenoch then came on a Spectator TV hustings and said, you know, all these arts graduates that can write essays on working class, you know, rather than doing a day's work. But she said that she'd obviously had a middle class experience in Nigeria, and then she'd come to the UK, and that's when she discovered what it was like to be working class, because she'd been working full time in McDonald's. And she's really defended that view. Do you think there is something in terms of working class is less about what you're born into as your experience, or do you think it's defined more by your birth?
well, I don't think Kemi Badenoch is working class. And actually, I think what it was really interesting was that when she then explained the comments, that wasn't really what she was trying to say. And there was, it almost told you everything that's so interesting about her, I think, in that she actually has got a really interesting background. She's really forthright about what she thinks. She's got a clarity of what she thinks. But the way she expressed that, there were so many better ways I thought she could have expressed that, to be able to say, it gave me an insight into what it's like when you are working a long shift at McDonald's and then there's no buses at the end of the night to get you home. She could have talked in much more relatable terms about her experience. So I don't think she should have said that she was working class, but I think if you accept the point that actually what she meant was it gave her an insight, I think that if she can use that, that will be more effective. In terms of what makes your class up, well, you know, it's all complicated now because people's occupations don't always relate. But I think most people would say it's a combination of like the job that you do, the wealth or the income that you have behind you and capital. But it's also about your social capital. And that is really hard to quantify. But those networks that you get, those kind of loose ties. So there are all kind of ways of categorising this. But I think the thing that I found really interesting, the research I did, is that if you ask people, they are more likely to say they're working class and they're middle class. And that has got stronger over the last few years rather than less. So I think that any political party that just pitches itself to middle class voters or to university graduates is never going to win an election. And I'm really proud that the Labour Party recognised that and has reorientated themselves so successfully.
Now, the final question is one we ask everyone, which is just, what is the worst advice you've ever been given in your life? Could be your career.
I mean, I've not really been given very much advice, which is probably says more about me than anything else.
You just don't think you need it. You just
well, no, I definitely did. The only thing I can think of actually is when I went to the end of university, so I didn't know what I wanted to do at any point. I've just followed the things I think have been interesting. Went to my university's career advisor for help and they didn't really come out with any particular gems, but the top of the list was sort of being an administrator in the arts. And I'm interested really in neither of those things. And it just showed to me, I hope university careers advice has got a lot better. But it also shows to me when you have educators who've got no experience of industry or the world out there, that we're not probably doing a good service by people. But I didn't follow that advice and just followed what I was interested in instead.
Thank you, Claire. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.